All right, this is Parshas Chayei Sarah, and which is deals with a couple of things. It deals with the death and burial and purchase of the Marat HaMachpelah, the Cave of the Patriarchs, which is the first part. And I have some classes online that deal with, I have two classes about that. So check it out, yutara.org. You can go to Rabbi Pinney Rosenthal, and you'll see, and put in Chayei Sarah, filter it, and the class will come up. Then you got the next episode is Avram dispatches his servant, which midrashically his name is Eliezer, to get a wife for Yitzchak, and I dealt with that in part, the end of that part of that episode. Today we're going to deal with a beginning part of that episode, okay? And then we have the third part of the Parsha, which is Avram remarries and has kids. As you know, why give up? So so that's the Parsha over, that's the Parsha outline. All right, so let's start off the class title is Parsha Chayei Sarah, Avram, Babka, and marriage. Where am I going with this?
No idea. Yeah. Where are you going with that?
You're going to, well, you know, buckle up. I'm going to take you on a ride. Here we go. A little Torah ride. Are you seeing the video? Here we go. We'll share screen action. All right. So this is a this is a classic. The backdrop is that Elaine and Jerry are invited to a dinner party. Okay, they want to get the world famous chocolate babka, but then of course mayhem ensues. Here we go.
See you later. See you later.
That's the last babka. They got the last babka.
I know. They're going in first with the last babka.
That was our babka.
You can't beat a babka.
We had that babka.
Heroes.
But what are we going to do now? We can't get the babka. The whole thing's useless.
Well, how about a carrot cake?
Carrot cake? And what, why is that a cake? You don't make carrots into a cake. I'm sorry.
Black forest?
Black forest? Too scary. You're in the forest.
Ooh.
What about Napoleon?
Napoleon? Who's he to have a cake? He was a ruthless warmonger. Might as well get a Mengele.
That was a babka. We heard that babka.
What's this one? That cinnamon babka.
Another babka?
There's chocolate and there's cinnamon.
Oh, well, we gotta get the cinnamon.
No, but they get the chocolate. We'll be going in with lesser babka.
I beg your pardon? Cinnamon takes a back seat to no babka. People love cinnamon. It should be on tables in restaurants along with salt and pepper. Anytime you eat this, oh, this is so good. What's in this? The answer invariably comes back. Cinnamon. Cinnamon. Again and again. Lesser babka? I think not.
49? I'll have a cinnamon babka.
And a black and white cookie for me. Peace.
All right. Anybody seen that classic Seinfeld?
I've seen that vignette.
Yeah, it's money every time. Anyways. All right, so let's... Okay, let's go to the sheet. Share screen. Hold on. Okay. Oh, did everybody see the sheet?
Yep.
Okay. Yep. Question number one. Why are Jerry and Elaine so dejected about not getting the last chocolate babka?
Because they wanted to be the heroes of the dinner, of the party.
Okay. All right, so I understand you're not the hero because you're not coming in with the chocolate babka. But what do they immediately feel?
Disappointment.
Not just disappointment.
Heated.
That they'll be judged.
They felt either were the hero or were the
villain.
Hero. Okay. All right?
Right.
In other words, if we can't bring chocolate babka to the thing, it's worthless. The whole episode, there's nothing we can do. And then Jerry starts to do the sale. Then they discover the phenomenon of cinnamon babka. And then, what was Elaine's argument against the cinnamon babka?
That it just won't be as good as the normal babka. It's just like, yeah.
Why
even bring it?
Right. Coming in with second best babka is like, it's not, why even bother? Why even bother? You're not doing premium babka. And you're bringing loser babka, a.k.a. cinnamon babka. No, that's it.
No bueno.
What?
I don't know. I'll admit.
No bueno.
Cinnamon babka is pretty good, I'll admit.
Okay, apparently that was Jerry's argument, which he accepted. You know, the cinnamon babka is not a forgotten stepchild to the chocolate babka. In fact, it's an equal to the chocolate babka. Okay. Anyway, let's move it into what kind of thinking is this called?
All or nothing.
All or nothing. Right.
Don't ask me how I know that.
All or nothing. All or nothing thinking. Okay. Now, let's read. Let me have Sean read me out this little definition. A cognitive
distortion is an automatic way of repeatedly interpreting a situation that causes us to not consider other ways of thinking about it. When we over-rely on cognitive distortions, we usually interpret events in such a way that fuels emotions such as anxiety, depression, or anger.
Right. So basically, Elaine and Jerry immediately got sucked up in a cognitive distortion that unless they bring in the chocolate babka, there's no point in doing anything. All or nothing. Either you're the hero or you're the zero. Okay? And they got to start getting angry. Okay? Now, obviously, that kind of cognitive distortion is a major piece of all the comedy of Seinfeld. Right? Because, like, basically the king of cognitive distortions is basically George. George is involved. His whole thinking is cognitive thinking, cognitive distorted thinking. All or nothing. We'll get into that. We'll explore that. Okay. So, let me ask you now. I'm going to ask you questions. Share an example of cognitive distortion that is common for people to say after an interview.
I did really poorly and they're not going to call me?
Well, based upon what? That's not a cognitive distortion. That might be an actual a lucid assessment of what occurred.
This is the perfect job for me?
It's either extreme. No, so one black and white thinking is like, the interview went for 45 minutes. And the person identified, you went to that school, and there was like sort of like a hesitation. And so the person immediately feels dejected that even though the rest of the conversation was pleasant, they seemed genuinely interested. The assumption is, they hate me, They don't want me. There's no chance. I'm done. Right? Now, what's the logical fallacy in that? What logical error is the person who's engaged in that cognitive distortion involved in?
They're basing the interviewer's feelings about them on the breath of time.
Okay. And that's true. Now, look, I don't want to dismiss body language is an important piece of data. All right, it's not nothing. In other words, in reading people, that is significant.
It's one data point. It's just one data point.
Exactly. In other words, rarely are situations either all good or all bad. But generally, there is a middle ground. There is complexity. There are shades of gray. Okay? And when the person walks out to interview, if they interviewed you, they might say, like, oh, he or she was good in this thing, not so good in this thing, and compared to the person we had this morning, might be a little bit stronger. You know what I'm saying? You can't really infer from that, but people automatically go to this, what they call this polarized thinking. You know what I'm saying? All or nothing. Here or zero. Or the other, as Taryn said, oh, they love the fact that I, let's say you speak French. Oh, you speak French. Oh, I got the job. Right? So that's another, you know, it could be also like, you know, one thing is like, you know, 100% all in or all out. Okay? Let me get some more. All right, share an example of cognitive distortion that's common for people to say after first dates.
He's perfect for me.
Correct. Why is that a cognitive distortion?
Because it's based off such a small interaction in such a bigger picture. And it's such an extreme, like rather than wanting to learn or know someone better, you automatically go down the aisle.
Right. He's the one. Amazing, right? Now, reality is, right, exactly. To know a person is a complicated thing, and people are complicated. You have to, date one that the person's either perfect. You could also, although you can know the person is, not for you. that does this a little more easier to know. I mean, if it's like, although it's not true, there are many people who are married today who had a horrible first date and did not want to go on a second date, but were encouraged by their friends to do it. Or they didn't go out, and then a year later were suggested and they went out again and it was a completely different experience. There's so many variables. I mean, it's an example I've said before. I met my wife 2 years before we were set up. We were introduced, zero interest. How is that possible? I'm married for 26 years, 6 kids in. Obviously, I'm interested in this woman, okay? But 2 years earlier, actually 3 years earlier, I was like a 21-year-old guy. I was like, not in the headspace of dating and marriage. So you can't. There's so many variables to make a grand declaration or general conclusion after one piece of is a cognitive distortion. I mean, that if you want to reduce all of George Costanza's things, like a woman will say something in the bar. And he'll either say, oh, she hates me. That's it. Nobody loves me. You know, he goes crazy, which is, of course, the essence of the whole comedic thing. All right. Next. Share an example of cognitive distortion that is common for people to say after eating a donut on the first day of their new diet.
Well, that diet was a nice idea.
Just, I can't diet. I'll just start tomorrow.
Right. I can't diet. I'm a failure. I'll never be successful. Versus, yes, I had a good day. I just overate once, and now I'm just going to go back on that. But no, we use it as a overgeneralization that we are a complete failure. We can't control ourselves. We'll never be able to maintain a thoughtful eating plan, and we shouldn't even bother. And now I should have one donut. I should double down and have a second donut. All right. Now, here's the more sophisticated question. All right. Is everybody comfortable with the idea? There is actually, like, there could be therapists identify at least 15 common cognitive distortions that our mind, you know, automatically puts into our mind. I'm just giving you like the most obvious example of all or nothing, hero or zero, overgeneralization, like the basic ones. There's so many. Now, here's a key question. Why do we fall into these mental mistakes? Or why does a person fall into why do we fall into this kind of thinking? All or nothing thinking. Let's just take one.
Emotions.
Yeah, but it's not, the emotions come after the thought. You know what I'm saying? The emotion is the reaction to our judgment that, they didn't like me. I'm not getting the job. Or they love me, I'm for sure getting the job. You know, either one, you know, no, why does our mind avoid the middle ground? We're going to either or. Or we overgeneralize. Or if we're in a situation.
Because it's easier?
Good. Scott, explain that to me. You're on the right road. What do you mean by
easier? It's just easier to go to like one extreme or the other before kind of going through the pros and cons in your head. Like you just make your snap decision and you go on from there regardless.
Why do you think we want to go with the quick and easy?
Because it's less painful.
Well, actually, but it caused you more pain.
In the long term. In the short term, we believe it's easier.
Right, exactly. That's kind of like where I was going.
We don't want to take the time and effort to actually analyze it.
That's it.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. So what you're saying is on point here. Now, there's a part of us, it's really an extension of the fact that we're being bombarded by information. You wake up in the morning, you stumble into the bathroom, you're going to brush your teeth, okay? If you had to break that down and mentally think of all the steps necessary to take the right toothbrush, take the right toothpaste, unscrew the cap, apply the right amount of toothpaste, rinse it once, you know, pre-rinse it with the toothbrush, brush a certain amount of time on the lower teeth, certain amount of time on the upper teeth, floss, whatever, you know, whatever what have we done? We don't think about it all. We've made it into sort of an automatic habit, a ritual. We call a thoughtless toothbrushing ritual. Now that's actually very critical because if you had to think through in every logical and all necessary steps of every single thing of the day, you'd be just simply mentally spent, exhausted. So the mind creates all these shortcuts to be able to make decisions and go right to action. You know what I mean? The more efficient way. What's the limitation of that?
It takes effort to do that.
Well, but should we invest effort on our toothbrushing ritual in the morning?
No. I think it's something that is very easily just sort of made into a robotic action.
Okay.
There are also certain things. Sorry. There are also certain things that are. Brushing your teeth is repetitive. Not only in the fact that brushing is literally up, you know, up, down, front, back, side, side, that kind of repetitive, but like no matter what day of the week it is, unless you decide to do it more times that day or you have a new toothpaste, the general steps of brushing your teeth are going to be the same,
yep.
Which is why it's something that we put on autopilot. Meanwhile, what goes into an interview, what happens during a date, and like that stuff can constantly, like the immediate after stuff could change here and there. And so I think part of it is maybe we let our brain kind of do those automatic responses in an effort to maybe a little bit avoid having to break down the specifics.
100%. In other words, the error that we're making is that we, all of us tend to, in other words, there are certain things in our day, in our actions, which the fact that they are done in a ritual kind of way is great. How you tie your shoes, how you brush your teeth, how you put on your pants, right leg versus left leg, you know what I mean? These activities do not require using of the mind, using of the brain. The problem is, we start to have these sort of like called mental cliff notes of how to navigate certain situations. Let's call it our automatic response. The problem with that is it fails to deal with the complexity of the situation. We react, wrongly, and then we cause ourselves, we make bad decisions. For example, another cognitive distortion is filtering. This is a classic situation. You ever been with a person that they'll have a situation, you go out for a fun day of, hanging out on a Sunday, you go to the park, you get some coffee, you have a little dessert, you're having a little schmooze, you're having a great time, okay? Okay? It's sunny out, it's beautiful in every way. But this person has the ability to filter out every positive element and only identify and highlight and bring to sharp relief all the annoying parts. Like, yes, we ordered the coffee. They brought the wrong one. We had to get the new one. Yes, the person was not as deferential. Our server was not as deferential as I hoped they were. They didn't have my ideal dessert. I had to second for my less favorite dessert. And they give you this entire tirade of all the things, all the defects of the day. Meanwhile, the day was objectively, it was sunny. It was good, the conversation flowed now, all the good things. But they have the ability to filter out all the positive aspects and focus on and harp on the negatives. Have you been with such a person?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, so their vision of reality, is their depiction of reality balanced and accurate?
No.
They are involved in a cognitive distortion. So the problem is, what the challenge is, and this is this approach to therapy was made famous by a guy named Dr. Aaron Beck, who I discovered as a new form of psychotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, okay? CBT. And basically, he believes his effects of dealing with depression and anxiety and anger is to identify what are the cognitive distortions, identify them, and be able to and have the person speak to them internally, have an internal speech to understand the sabotaging thought that is responsible to the negative feeling. You know what I'm saying? So when the person comes out of the interview and says, well, I blew it, that's it, nobody likes me, I'm never getting a new job, versus, or let me identify what went well. Let me identify what I felt did not go well. Let's see how it goes. Because obviously, I'm not the interviewer. I don't know 100%. And then have a balanced sort of a view. Okay. All right, this is critical. All right, now we're going to shift in. The Rambam wrote a unit called Hilchot Deot, Laws of Character Traits. This is just a little blurb in chapter 2, the seventh halacha. Let me have Shmuel read it out.
Laws of Character Traits 2:7. One should neither be constantly laughing and a jester, nor sad and depressed, but happy. Our sages declare jesting and lightheadedness accustom one to lewdness. They also directed that a man should not laugh without control, nor be sad and mournful, or receive everyone in a friendly manner.
Hold on, stop right there. What is the emotional point that a person should try to aspire to get to as throughout their day?
Be happy, but not too happy. Right. Like, kind of.
Yes. Like what you call roughly in the middle. In order to, you're not depressed. And you're not like a laughing idiot. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're not skipping down the street and stuff.
You're in a positive, centered midpoint. Go on.
Similarly, he should not be greedy, rushing for wealth and possessions, nor lazy and an idler from work. Rather, he should be of a goodly eye and limit his business endeavors so that he may occupy himself with Torah study. He should be happy with the little which is his lot. He should not be quarrelsome.
We'll stop right there. So he should not be a guy who's like super, super ambitious to make money, money hungry, which we call in our society, greedy, the greedy bastard guy. Okay. Nor a guy who's like, just like, sitting on the couch and just, waiting for the government and charity to bail him out. You know what I'm saying? Or mom or dad. You know what I'm saying? That midpoint.
There's a question on the first paragraph. Why does it connect jesting and lightheadedness to lewdness? What's the
basically, that's an interesting question. Let me, Sean, I'll get it back. Let me finish off the halacha and we'll get to that. I'll get back to that. There's a lot of stuff here, but let's keep on going.
Okay. He should not be quarrelsome, of envious temperament, full of desire, nor pursue honor. Our sages have said envy, desire, and honor remove a man from life in this world.
Or go on.
Oh, right. Sorry. The general principle is that one should follow the midpoint quality of each character trait until all his traits are aligned at the midpoint. This is what is implied by Solomon's statement: calculate the journey of your foot and make all of your ways established.
Okay. So the Rambam is saying that the best way is that a person is not living the life of extremes. Okay? They're not overly jesting and like laughing and jesting, you know, nor morose, negative, depressed, sad. Okay. Shouldn't be aggressively running after money as that being the chief thing, but not being lazy either, you know, a middle spot and be happy with and not be jealous of others, people's wealth. And be happy with what you have. Third, should not be an angry guy or envious or full of desires or running after honor. Okay? So the key line here is calculate the journey of your foot. So in other words, what the Rambam is telling us that the Torah is saying that basically that our principles of action, how we navigate life, demands, the key word here is calculate. We're not to be involved in the kind of lazy thinking, which, of course, brings us, you know, lots of unnecessary hardship, sadness, depression, anxiety, but to really work out to navigate this. Now, how one does that, that's the topic of this total, you know, many of his chapters. I can't reduce it all down of his methodology, but that's the main point. The point is that a person's inner world should not be just left to randomness. It should not be left to go on autopilot. You know what I'm saying? And that's what the therapists talk about, cognitive distortions, is really a kind of not training ourselves to think about, to be reflective, to think about our life experiences in a thoughtful manner, but rather go for the default setting. It's called the Times New Roman 12 font setting of like, oh, my reaction is I'm going to filter all the bad stuff out, all the good stuff out, or all the bad stuff out, and come to an extreme reaction. Or I'm going to be all or nothing. Or I'm going to make a generalization based upon two pieces of information. You know, all these kind of, and then have an emotional reaction, either extreme joy or extreme sadness based upon little data. Okay? Shmuel, you had your hand up.
Oh, yeah. It seems to me often that in the Torah, and speaking in a very general sense when I say the Torah, in the Torah, there is very often ways people should or should not act, things we should or shouldn't do. But I think this in particular is really interesting to me, this layout or design of how one should behave throughout the day and throughout their life. But it doesn't seem to give, you know, if someone struggles with any of these things,
yep,
where do they find help for that and correcting those behaviors? Or is it simply that the very last sentence is the antidote for that, by always calculating what you're doing in your day, your month, your year, and your life? That'll help alleviate many of these things.
Yes, that will help, but it's very possible that a person might need a therapeutic, in other words, it's very hard if a person has, you know, a person has, is prone to having these mental, you know, these cognitive distortions rule their life. You know, say they always go to either hero versus zero thinking, all or nothing, right?
Right.
To undo that, it can get to a point that the Ram has a phrase in the Shmona Prakim, one of his works, where he calls that in Judaism we have a rofe gufos, we have a doctor of the body, and then we have a rofe nefashos, a doctor of the soul. Okay. And that's a big tradition within, you know, that to go to a person who is adept at that. And we call that, in part nowadays, part of that is therapy.
Right. What was it? But what was it 1500 years ago? Because there weren't talk therapists 1500 years ago.
Well,
they were known by another name.
Well, while the Rambam, that's what he's really writing at here in the Laws of Character, is to deal with these different things, and he has lots of writings about that, and to sort of to deal with depression and anxiety and those types of issues. These are issues that we know, but that was the job of the Talmud Chacham, or the Rofe Nefashos, the healer of the soul, would be engaged in dealing with basically helping a person get to an equilibrium, to that centered happy place.
Okay.
Nowadays, that's a massive industry called therapy, and there's all kinds of modes and schools of thought and this and that. You know what I mean? So, but ultimately, if a person's not neurotic or psychotic, a person who's not, you know, fairly balanced, going through the life's difficulty, how to deal with that is, you know, having a, I mean, really, when if a person has a friend, discusses over a problem, really that person's, their friend is functioning as a quasi, maybe poorly trained therapist.
Sure.
they're analyzing. Now, that sometimes compounds the matter, because that person may not be adept to really provide a thoughtful solution to the matter. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I'm just seeing what I'm seeing. The general point is just to be aware about is to apply the strengths of mind, not just to like obvious problems or complicated to think out, but even these life experiences, which we oftentimes fall into a cognitive distortion. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Which you know, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that, you know, all or nothing thinking is not true. That life typically, every experience has a mix of, you know, has a complex mix of things. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, although I'd say that might be a piece of wisdom that to you might appear very obvious, but to some people that takes a long time to learn.
No, I'm not saying it's obvious. I'm just I don't think it's. If I felt it was obvious, I wouldn't be sharing it tonight. I think people are. In general, psychologically not that aware.
Yeah.
And if they are aware, they're more aware of others, but of their own world, their own inner world is sort of like a mystery.
Yeah, it's hard to shine that spotlight on yourself.
Right, they don't really understand why they do what they do. Why am I doing this? You know, like the old classic situation, like, you know, it's like the daughter that calls up her mother and gets into the same fight that she's had with her mom literally 300 times before. It's like Groundhog Day. You know what I'm saying? Or the guy that gets in the same quibble with his brother or his, you know, father about the same issue, and it's expressed itself in the same way. So clearly, the learning curve is not going so well over here. You know what I'm saying? These are just or why the same kinds of things happen. Why does a person get into the same kind of bad or unproductive relationships? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, why am I, why am I dating all, why do I seem to be dating all the wrong people over here? Now, the natural point is, goes, well, it's all about those people. Those people suck. All right. But at a certain point, it's statistically, for every person you're going at, it's not working out. It's not them. It's us. You know what I'm saying?
And yeah,
it's actually more helpful when something doesn't work out is to actually assume, to analyze carefully, you know, without falling into these cognitive distortions, you know, what did I do to contribute to this lack of success? You know what I'm saying? As Shlomo Melch says, calculate the journey of your foot. In other words, really calculate, in other words, really think into it, to be a reflective person. This way, ironically, you know, Judaism agrees with Socrates. Living an unreflective life is not worth living. Not that you should feel bad about it. If a person makes a mistake, we're all going to make mistakes, but just to go through the motions and, you know, and not thinking through. And if I'm not making a breakthrough, bring in expert opinion. Maybe people who are not in the situation. You know what I'm saying? Expert opinion, etc. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Guys, Julie?
Yeah.
All right, Darren. All right, let's go on. Now let's get to our Parsha. You don't have no idea where I'm going with this. I love that. Anyways. All right, so Mendel, read us out. This is when there's so much stuff here, but a wife for Isaac. Yeah, take it.
A wife for Isaac, chapter 24, verse 1. Abraham was old, well advanced in years, and God had blessed Abraham with everything. He said to the senior servant of his household, who was in charge of all that he owned, "Place your hand under my thigh. I will bind you by an oath to God, Lord of heaven and earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live. Instead, you must go to my native land, to my birthplace, and obtain a wife for my son Yitzchak. But what if the girl does not want to come back with me to this land?" asked the servant. "Shall I bring your son back to the land that you left?" "Be most careful in this respect," replied Abram. "Do not bring my son back there. God, the Lord of heaven, took me away from my father's house, the land of my birth. He spoke to me and made an oath, to your offspring I will give this land. He will send his angel before you, and you will indeed find a wife there for my son. If the girl does not want to come back with you, then you shall be absolved of my oath. But no matter what, do not bring my son back there. The servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and he took an oath regarding this.
Okay. All right, so basically, Avram is deputizing his chief of staff, who the Midrash identifies as Eliezer, right? To go travel a couple hundred miles to Aram Naharaim in Mesopotamia to get a wife for his son Yitzchak, ideally from the family, and if not from the family, from the town. But what under no circumstance should he do?
Bring Yitzchak to that land, or allow the woman who wants to be his wife to stay in that land. Well, I'm not sure if that's true.
No, you can't. In other words, under no circumstance should Yitzchak be brought if the woman, let's say the perfect match is found. But she says, I don't want to leave my family. I mean, remember back then, if you travel 200 miles, right, you're not going to see your family pretty much ever. You're like gone. You know, we take it for granted, you know. Yeah. You know, all of us tomorrow could be in Tokyo. I mean, you know. But that was not the case. And so that was a real concern. So Avram said, under no circumstances shall you take my son back there. Now, what other thou shall not should he do? What other rules, ironclad rule did Avram lay down for Eliezer in finding a proper wife for Yitzchak?
Not to take a daughter from Canaan, where he was living then.
Right. You can't take a local. No local women.
Which, I mean, that in itself is interesting. Like, he settled there. I mean, the assumption would be that he settled in a place that is a good place, but apparently it's not. It's extremely dangerous.
All right. So we have a couple. We have a number of questions here.
So
what are all the questions here?
I mean, the flip side of that same question is, okay, you left one place, but now you're sending your servant specifically back to the place that you were commanded to leave for a wife for your son. I think that seems like the other side of that same question.
Right. So number one, why is Avram insisting going back there, A? B, why can't Yitzchak go there and be with his beloved wife? And C, why is there a prohibition on the Canaanite women? And is that only the initial prohibition, or is there in fact a conditional prohibition? So what are logically the, now, what else does he say? Avram tell Eliezer? There's a paradox here, also. Look at verse 7.
God said that he'll find a wife for him in that land that he sent him to.
Well, he says, God said, I'll give you this land. But Avram saying, he will send his angel before you, and you will indeed find a wife there for my son.
Right.
And then verse 8. One second, hold on. If the girl does not want to come back with you, then you will be absolved from my oath. But no matter what, do not bring my son back there.
What's the point of the angel finding the wife?
Right. In other words, is Avram confident or not confident?
not super confident.
Apparently not so super confident. So then what's the angel then? All right. So now how many different possibilities does Avram lay out? Possibility number one, that Eliezer is successful in finding a wife from not only of his country, but from his family. That's the gold standard. Second option?
He doesn't.
No, second option is not from the family, but from my land.
Okay.
Third option?
She doesn't want to come back.
And she doesn't want to come back. So therefore, that option is so Avram has said has ixnayed him going over bringing Yitzchak back. So therefore, does that mean that Yitzchak can now marry a local?
Yeah. What's the option after that?
Right. So Rashi says, "Then you'll be clear from my oath and take a wife from him from the daughters of Aner, Eshkol, Mamre, which were the local allies." The Ramban argues that in that case, no, you cannot, on no circumstance can I get a Canaanite wife. Because they, as later on in the Torah, they are the most deep, they're like super idolatrous, they're like super pagans. Even if the family back home might be what? Idolatrous, but since they have a respect for their grand, you know, relative, Avram, they're more prone to be open to becoming a disciple of Avram. So that's why they're selected as being better. Okay? Now, why is he not wanting to bring him there? Let's read the Radak. All right, Julie, read out the Radak.
Abraham said to him, "Beware that you do not bring my son there again. For Abraham did not want the claim on the land of Israel, which God had promised him, and which he had been established through his physical presence in that land, to become subject to doubt through an even temporary migration of Yitzhak."
Right. Now, Avram is trying to establish this monotheistic, ethical monotheistic religion, okay, and connected with the land of Canaan, right? That's what he's teaching the people about this, right? So if Avram dies and Yitzhak moves back to Haran or Urka, you know, wherever, back to Mesopotamia, what's going to happen to the religion?
It's going to end.
It may be threatened. It may be polluted.
It will disappear because he's trying to establish a lifestyle in a certain area. You know what I'm saying? Why isn't Yitzchak getting a wife? According to many of them, a fortune is because they are extremely paganistic, extremely licentious. Okay, so they're from a qualitative standpoint. Not now, Rashi does not agree. In other words, they're preferred. They're not the first choice, or they're not the second choice. So first of all, and then Avram says, "Oh, but don't worry. There'll be a God will send a angel." This is a very important point. He said, why is he confident about, why is he confident yet not confident about the angel? Okay, read verse 7 in its, read 7 in its totality. This is a very important principle. Verse 7. I will highlight it. Why did he even have the confidence to say that God's going to send an intermediary, some sort of help, divine help, to help Eliezer find a wife? And yet he's not 100% sure. This is a very important principle. The reason is because he's inducting that from the fact that Hashem didn't tell him just to go to Canaan, but leave his family household, move to Canaan to really build a whole new civilization, right? So therefore, what is most likely to get divine help? Well, ensuring that the next generation is properly, there's a succession of power. So therefore, it's the most eligible for divine intervention. Why is he not 100% confident? And this is the basic point. Here's another example. Avram is never 100% confident that he is going to get divine help. We call hashkacha pratit, divine help. We never know. You can make a good case that it's a good case that it will. And if you read the story later on, he, in fact, does work out. Okay, there's a divine help. But Avram never banked on it. Here's the interesting paradox of the Tanakh. You ready for this one? This is a bumper sticker here. The people in the Tanakh who are the closest to God never expected that God would help them out. Yet Hashem did. Frequently, the people who are not as close to God are confident that Hashem is going to help them out. And oftentimes are sadly disappointed. Okay. So the bottom line is, this is not up to us to figure this out. Okay? Now, how does this go back to our conversation about cognitive distortion? What do you see before Avram sits down with his chief of staff, Eliezer? What did Avram do? What did Avram do? Which is obvious from this entire presentation.
He calculated and made a logical or like a plan to get his son a wife in the best way that he knew, instead of just relying on an angel showing him a wife.
That's A. But he had a plan A. He had a plan B. He had a plan C. In other words, he assumed a full range of situations here. You know what I'm saying? You don't know how things are going to unfold, and you got to work out the possibilities. Okay? Now, there was certain absolutes. Avram did not want him to have him. He did not want. What was the absolutes here? Absolute number one: under no circumstance should Yitzchak go and move to Mesopotamia to marry that fantastic wife. Why, says the Radak? Because basically, it would basically deep six the success of the Abrahamic tradition, being connected to the land. Okay, that's the end. I did a class on this last year, about the wells coming up in the next Parsha. I think I did it last year or 2 years ago. Check out the story about the wells after Avram dies. Okay? So that's number one. And also, according to many of the Meforshim, the second red line was Yitzchak would not marry a woman who's from Canaan. Rashi argues that says it's not desired, it's not preferred, but in the case in plan C, it's okay, provided Yitzchak, more important that Yitzchak stays put and keeps the Avram shop, if you were, quote unquote, open for business. This is the key thing. Over the 12 years I've been, you know, working with students at MJE, whether it becomes issues of dating, whether it becomes issues of jobs, the two major concerns of people who are in the ages 20s and 30s, invariably the challenge that they faced came from these various cognitive distortions. You know, as Taryn said at the beginning, like, oh, when I first date, he's perfect. It's great. You know, or the opposite. Oh, you know, he or she did not have this quality. He's a loser. It's not going to work out. And therefore, you know, the good opportunity after good opportunity is shared, and it's then, you know, tossed away. So you see, Avram calculated his journey. So every outcome, plan A, plan B, plan C, was worked out. And he also didn't have confidence. He felt that there was a good chance God's going to send, quote unquote, an angel, an intermediator, some divine help that will allow his chief of staff, Eliezer, to be successful. But he was also not 100% confident that will happen because you can't know the divine plan. You know, that's not our calculation. You know what I'm saying? So you see as a way of life, Avram's approach. And really, we can be very successful by avoiding, you know, various cognitive distortions, you know, all or nothing thinking, overgeneralizations, these things that, because our mind is naturally, let's call it lazy, and wants to have a quick way of just handling problems, a quick processing, the bottom line is that it's sometimes the long way is in fact the short way. And to reflect about all the possibilities is, because life is very complicated, and you don't want to provide simple solutions to complicated situations, and therefore can you'll generally oftentimes be miserable. So that's really, and you see Avram really was the master of this. He worked it all out. He thought everything through. Last week we dealt last year about him dealing with how he's going to navigate the Abimelech, and the week before that, dealing with Paro. He worked at all the angles. Even if the choices were terrible, all the options were terrible, but he found what's the least terrible? That's sometimes your best, you know. Sometimes your plan C is, you know, better than your plan D, and you got to go with that. So that really is a powerful lesson for having a life which is just more happy. Just a happier existence. Because oftentimes our own mental distortions, cognitive distortions, make us unnecessarily miserable. And we can be happier by just, you know, trying to be extra mindful of that. And you can try to see the complexity and not falling into simple cognitive or, you know, logical traps. As we see that our ancestor Avram was. He was the king of this. He was the master of this. And that's where we read about these stories. Why? Because we're supposed to learn from him. It's as simple as that. So I'm just sharing one idea. There are many ideas in the parsha. We just did Tem Sukkim, but it's already 9:02, so we're going to call it a night. Any questions? Why don't we answer Sean? Sean asked a question back of the Rambam. Jesting and lightheadedness, accustomed unto lewdness. Basically, the idea is like this: to get into a seriously sexually inappropriate state, you can't go from a cold, thoughtful, reflective mode to engaging in, licentious behavior. You need to get there. In other words, there's a mental journey, and the first, part of flirting, like the classic, Halloween movie. Does the guy and the girl just go off to bed out of nowhere, or are they at the bar and what do they start doing? Sean, what do they start doing? I mean, in every movie.
Well, at the bar, they're like flirting and.
Right, they're flirting, they're joking around, and they're drinking, which of course allows them to be more joking and more, and that's it. When they're able to shift into that kind of state, then that's when the affair or the one night stand or the hookup, whatever term you want to use, occurs. It can't just occur out of like the guy looks up from his Excel spreadsheet and then has an affair with a woman. It doesn't work that way. There has to be that mental transition. And that transition, the Rambam tells, it quotes the Chazal of the schok, or the Hebrew is schok, joking around, kalos rosh, lightheadedness, where you're like, just like completely like losing yourself in laughter is really the state where the person is open and eligible to get into a sexualized, licentious kind of zone. Is that clear, Sean?
Yeah, that's clear.
So doesn't mean the guy should be a stiff, you know, clinical person. Should be pleasant and happy, but not losing their cells in laughter. You know, that loss in laughter is not a good, does not bring out, you know, good things don't happen when the guy or gal is in that zone. Typically bad things happen. That's a separate, but that's not really the essence of the class. That's the point. All right, any other questions? All right, so I'll see many of you on tomorrow night at MJE.
See you tomorrow, Rabbi.
Tomorrow, Rabbi.
Have a good night.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.